David Benbrook insisted that he should host a victory party to celebrate the Battle of Abu Klea and the imminent arrival of the relief column in the city. Because of the paucity of food and drink, Rebecca decided on an alfresco dinner rather than a formal display of silver and crystal in the dining room. They sat on folding canvas campaign chairs on the terrace overlooking the Maidan and listened to the military band joining in with the better-known choruses. In the intervals, while the band regained their breath, they toasted the Queen, General Wolseley, and, for the benefit of Consul Leblanc, the King Leopold of the Belgians. After much inner communication with his conscience, David decided to bring up from the cellars the single case of Krug champagne that he had been hoarding all these months. A little premature, perhaps, but once they arrive, we'll probably be too busy to think about it. This was the first time that General Gordon had accepted one of Rebecca's invitations to dinner and entertainment. He wore an immaculate dress uniform with a red fez. His boots were polished to a high gloss, and the Egyptian Star of Ishmael glinted on his breast. He was in a relaxed, expansive mood, although Rebecca noticed the nervous tick below his eye. He nibbled a minute portion of the food on offer. Green cake, durra bread, and cold roast bird of indeterminate species, which had been gunned down by the host. He chain-smoked his Turkish cigarettes, even when he stood to make a short speech. He assured the company that the steamers crammed with British troops were racing even at that hour up against the rapids of the Shabluka Gorge, and that he confidently expected them to reach the city by the following evening. He commended the other guests and the entire populace, of every colour and nationality, for their heroic resistance and sacrifice, and gave thanks to Almighty God that their efforts had not been in vain. Then he thanked the consul and his daughters for their hospitality, and took his leave. The mood of the remaining guests was at once much lighter. The twins were given special dispensation to delay their bedtime until midnight and were allowed a sherry glass of the precious champagne. Saffron quaffed hers like a sailor on shore leave, but Amber took a minute sip and made a face. When Rebecca was looking the other way, she poured the rest into her twins' glass, much to Saffron's glee. Amber was becoming increasingly quiet and wan as the evening progressed. She took no part in the singing, which Rebecca thought odd. Amber had a sweet, true voice and loved to sing. She refused when David asked her to dance the polka with him. "You're so quiet and subdued. Are you feeling unwell, my darling?"
"A little, Daddy, but I do love you so much."
"Would you like to go up to bed? I'll give you a dose of salts. That'll fix it."
"Oh, no, goodness me, no. It's not that bad."
Amber forced a smile, and David looked worried, but did not pursue the matter. He went off to dance with Saffron instead. Consul Leblanc also noticed Amber's unusual behaviour. He came to sit beside her, held her hand in an avuncular manner, and launched into a long, complicated joke about a German, an Englishman, and an Irishman. When he reached the climax, he doubled over with laughter, and tears ran down his pink cheeks. Although she saw nothing funny in the story, Amber laughed dutifully, but then stood up and went to Rebecca, who was dancing with Ryder Courtney. Amber whispered in her elder sister's ear, and Rebecca left Ryder, took the younger girl's hand, and hurried indoors with her. David saw them leave, and he and Saffron followed. When they reached the foot of the staircase, Rebecca and Amber were on the first landing above them.
"Where are you going?" David called after them. "Is anything the matter?"
Still holding hands, Rebecca and Amber turned to face him. Suddenly, Amber groaned and doubled over. With an explosive rush of gas and liquid, her bowels started to empty. It poured out of her like a yellow waterfall and went on and on, forming a deep, spreading puddle at her feet. David was the first to recover his wits.
"Cholera!" he said.
At that dread word, Saffron thrust the fingers of both hands into her mouth and screamed.
"Stop that," Rebecca ordered, but her own voice was almost a scream.
She tried to lift Amber, but the yellow discharge was still spurting out of her and splattered down the front of Rebecca's long satin evening dress. Ryder had heard Saffron scream and ran in from the terrace.
He took in the scene almost instantly. He dashed back to where they had dined and swept the heavy damask cloth off the long table, sending silver candlesticks and table ornaments crashing to the floor. He raced up the stairs. Amber was still voiding copiously. It seemed impossible that such a small body could contain so much liquid. It was running down the staircase in a rivulet. Ryder shook out the damask like a cape and enfolded her in it, lifted her as though she were a doll, and ran with her up the stairs.
"Please put me down, Ryder," Amber begged. "I will dirty your lovely new suit. I cannot stop myself. I am so ashamed."
"You are a brave girl. There is nothing to be ashamed of," Ryder told her. Rebecca was at his side.
"Where is the bathroom?" he asked her. "This way."
She ran ahead and threw open the door. Ryder carried Amber in and laid her in the galvanized bath. "Get her soiled clothes off her and sponge her down with cool water," he ordered. "She's burning up. Then force her to drink. Weak warm tea, gallons of it. She must keep drinking. She has to replace every drop of the fluid she has lost." He looked at David and Saffron in the doorway. "Call Nazira to help you. She knows about this disease. I must go back to the Ibis to fetch my medical chest. While I'm gone, you must keep her drinking." Ryder raced through the streets. He was fortunate that for this one night General Gordon had relaxed the curfew so that all the populace might celebrate the relief of the city. Bakshit had stowed the medical chest in its usual place under his bunk in the main cabin of the Ibis. He rummaged through it swiftly, searching for what he needed to staunch Amber's diarrhea and replace the mineral salts that she had lost. He knew he had little time. Cholera is a swift killer. The death of the dog, they called it. It could kill a robust adult in hours, and Amber was a child. Already her body had been stripped of fluid. Soon every muscle and sinew would scream for liquid, terrible cramps would twist her, and she would die a desiccated husk. For a dreadful moment he thought that the vital packets of dirty white powder were missing, then remembered that he had moved them to the lockers in the galley for safety. In the cholera-torn city they were worth more than diamonds. The powder was packed in a woven sisal bag. There was enough to treat 5 or 6 cases. He had bought it at a usurious price from the abbot of a Coptic monastery deep in the gorge of the Blue Nile. The abbot had told him that the chalky powder was mined by his monks from a secret deposit tucked away in the mountains. Not only did it have a powerful binding effect on the bowels, it was also close in character and composition to those minerals purged from the human body by the disease. Ryder had been sceptical until Bakshit had been struck down with cholera, and Ryder had pulled him through with liberal doses of the powder. He stuffed everything he needed into an empty dara sack and ran back to the consulate. When he climbed the stairs to the bathroom, he found that Amber was still in the bath. She was naked, and Rebecca and Nazira were sponging her from the basin of warm, soapy water that Saffron held. David hovered ineffectually in the background, holding a tin mug of warm black tea. The stench of vomit and feces still hung heavily in the room, but Ryder was careful not to show disgust. "Has she vomited?"
"Yes," replied David, "but only some of this tea. I don't think she has anything else inside her."
"How much has she drunk?" Ryder demanded, as he snatched the mug from the other man's hand and poured a handful of the powder into it.
"2 mugs and a bit," said David proudly.
"Not enough," Ryder snapped, "not nearly enough.
She won't take any more."
"Oh, yes, she will," said Ryder. "If she can't drink it, I will give it to her with an enema tube." He carried the mug to the bath. "Amber, did you hear what I said?" She nodded. "You don't like enemas, do you?" She shook her head vehemently, and her sodden curls dangled in her eyes. "Then drink!" He placed one hand behind her head and held the cup to her lips. She gulped it down painfully, then lay back gasping. Already wasted by prolonged starvation, her body was now dehydrated and skeletal. The change that had taken place in the hour he had been away was dramatic. Her legs were as thin as those of a bird, her ribs as distinct as the fingers of a hand. The skin on her sunken, moon-pale belly seemed translucent so that he could see the network of blue veins under it. Ryder poured another handful of powder into the mug, and filled it with warm tea from the kettle that stood close at hand. "Drink," he ordered, and she choked it down. She was panting weakly, and her eyes had sunk into plum-coloured sockets.
I have no clothes on. Please don't look at me, Ryder.
He stripped off his moleskin jacket and covered her. I promised not to look at you if you promised to drink. He refilled the mug and poured the powder into it. As she drank it, her belly bulged out like a balloon. The gases in it rumbled, but she did not void again. Ryder refilled the mug.
I can't drink any more. Please don't make me, she begged.
Yes, you can. You made me a promise. She forced down that mug and another. Then there was a strong ammoniac odour, and a yellow trickle of urine ran down the bottom of the bath to the plug hole.
You've made me wet myself like a baby.
She was weeping softly with shame. Good girl, he said. That means you're making more water than you are losing. I'm so proud of you. He understood the trespasses he had already made on her modesty, so he stood up. But I'm going to let Rebecca and Safi look after you now. Don't forget your promise. You must keep drinking. I'll wait outside. Before he left the bathroom, he whispered to Rebecca,
I think we may have beaten it. She's out of immediate danger, but the cramps will begin soon. Call me at the first sign. We will have to massage her limbs or the pain will become unbearable.
From his sack, he handed her the bottle of coconut oil he had brought from the Ibis.
Tell Nazira to take this down to the kitchen and warm it to blood heat. No more than that. I will stay close.
The other dinner guests had left hours ago, and everything was quiet. Ryder and David settled down to wait on the top step at the head of the staircase. They chatted in a desultory fashion. They discussed the news of the relief column and argued about when the steamers would arrive. David agreed with Chinese Gordon's estimate, but Ryder did not. Gordon is always conservative with the truth. He says whatever suits his purpose best. I'll believe in the steamers when they tie up in the harbour. In the meantime, I will keep up steam in the Ibis. Out in the night, an owl hooted mournfully, then again, and a third time. Restlessly, David stood up and went to the window. He leant on the sill and looked down on the river. When the midnight owl hoot thrice, to wit, to woo, with one breath, then in a trice, it heralds death.
Oh, that's superstitious nonsense, said Ryder. And what's more, it does not scan.
Ha, you're probably right, David admitted. My nursemaid repeated it to me when I was five, but she was the wicked witch in person and loved to frighten us children. Then he straightened up and peered down towards the river bank. There's a boat out there, close in to the beach. Ryder went across to join him at the window.
Where?
There. Oh, no, it's gone now. I swear it was a boat, a small felucca. Probably a fisherman laying his nets. From the bathroom they heard Amber cry out in anguish. They rushed back to her. She was curled into a ball. The wasted muscles in her limbs were like whipcords as the spasms tightened them almost to snapping point. They lifted her out of the bath and laid her on the clean towels that Rebecca and Nazira spread on the tiled floor. Ryder rolled up his sleeves and knelt over her. Nazira poured warm coconut oil into the cup of his hands and he began to massage Amber's twisted legs. He could feel the ropes and knots under the skin.
Rebecca, take the other leg.
Nazira and Safi, her arms, he ordered.
Do it this way.
While they worked, David dribbled more of the tea mixture into their patient's mouth. Rebecca watched Ryder's hands as he worked. They were broad and powerful, but gentle. Under them, Amber's muscles gradually relaxed.
It's not over yet, Ryder warned them.
There'll be more. We must be ready to start again as the next spasm sees her.
What depths there are to this man, Rebecca thought. What fascinating contradictions.
Sometimes he is ruthlessly resourceful. At others he is filled with compassion and generosity of spirit. Would I not be foolish to let him go? Before the hour was up, the next cramps had locked Amber's limbs, so they fell to work on her again, and were forced to keep it up through the rest of the night. Just before daybreak, when all were reaching their own limits of exhaustion, Amber's limbs gradually straightened, and the knots softened and relaxed. Her head rolled to one side, and she fell asleep.
"She has turned the corner," Ryder whispered. "But we must still take care of her. You must make her drink the powder mixture again as soon as she wakes. She must eat also. Perhaps you might feed her a porridge of durra and green cake. I wish we had something more substantial, like chicken broth, but that is the best we can do. She will be weak as a newborn infant for days, perhaps weeks. But she has not scoured since midnight, so I hope and believe that the germs, as Joseph Lister is pleased to call the wee beasties that cause the trouble, have been purged from her." He picked up his damp, soiled jacket from the floor. "You know where to find me, Rebecca. If you send a message, I will come at once."
"I'll see you to the door." Rebecca stood up.
As they went out into the passage, she took his arm.
"You are a warlock, Ryder. You've worked magic for us. I don't know how the Benbrook family can ever thank you."
"Don't thank me. Just say a prayer for old Abbot Michael, who robbed me of 50 Maria Theresa dollars for a bag of chalk." At the door she reached up and kissed him, but when she felt his loins stir, she pulled away.
"You are a satyr as well as a warlock," she managed a faint smile. "But not now. We shall attend to that business at the first opportunity. Perhaps tomorrow, after the relief force arrives, when we are all safe from the evil dervish."
"I will hold myself on a short rein," he promised. "But tell me, dearest Rebecca, have you given any further thought to my proposal?"
"I am sure you will agree, Ryder, that at this dire time in our lives, my first thoughts must be for Amber and the rest of my family. But each day my affection for you increases. When this dreadful business is over, I feel sure that we will have something of value to share, perhaps for the remainder of our days."
"Then I shall live in hope,"